Hey Peter, thank you for coming in today. You have such a really outstanding background, really just amazing contribution across so many different areas as a futurist, as an educator advisor, as a past diplomat. But you're constantly creating and delivering value across so many different communities, whether it's CEO communities and corporations or UN or NGOs, you name it, you're there in some capacity and
Thank you.
helping them and contributing. So, thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with our audience.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Peter, one of the questions and my audience is always curious about is you've got this marvelous history of contribution, both on the personal and professional side. In fact, across every dimension, very multidisciplinary, but also transdisciplinary in every respect. And what were those inflection points in your life that created this person, this wonderful person you are today? And it could have been something when you were like 3 or 5 years old. It could have been in the family, it could have been outside the family, mentors, it could be something in school. It could be something that was outside of that impinged or had this sort of impact on your life. But what are those three sort of magic inflection points in your life?
Well, I would say one of them, excuse me, is my Uncle Bill. He was traveling more than most of my family. And that being said, a lot of my relatives have been in upstate New York and Rochester, New York area for a very long time and haven't left there. But he traveled often. He read widely, was always reading about history, reading about other places. And so conversations with him about the many places that one can explore in the world, the many adventures one can have, started opening my door and my mind to think more about other places and other adventures. And of course, he was an influence throughout my early life. And so conversations with my uncle, that was definitely something very significant. Another key inflection point, I would jump ahead a bit and talk about my undergrad years. That was a time when I had a great opportunity to work for the first online textbook seller. And so to during the dot-com boom, and it's time when it was booming and it's busting. And that was a great opportunity to learn a lot about a company that was going fast. Unfortunately, it was a company that made some of the wrong decisions. I recall being at one of their meetings, one of the conferences where they're bringing these students like myself who are working for them part-time to these national conferences for training. And they kept talking about OPM. And one of the students asked, "What is OPM?" I said, "Oh, it's other people's money. We don't have to worry about investment. That guy right there is going to keep giving us more money." And that made me really start thinking a lot about ethics in business. And really the importance of ethics. This CEO was doing nothing illegal, but it certainly wasn't the right thing to be doing or the right way to be treating his investor capital. Indeed, they went public about 6 months later and their stock price went to almost nothing. The company was badly run. But it was definitely a learning experience to be around that CEO and to learn about what he had done, to learn what not to do in that regard. And finally, I would say the time that I spent working with Citibank in Mexico City, that was a very interesting point. I'd lived outside the US briefly before that in Chile and in Spain, but I'd never worked professionally. So working in the investment banking unit at Citibank for a summer, that was really a space that opened up my mind and also made me realize how much I had in common with the people working on my team, despite different backgrounds, different countries we'd been in, that we shared common interests in so many ways. And that's what led me even more so towards this more globalist view of the world, where home is more my tribe, my group of friends, my networks, groups like YPO, groups like the BMW Responsible Leaders Network, rather than just one specific place.
So that's really interesting. So you had a family member who provided this sort of broad perspective, right? A very inclusive, kind of diverse perspective, and that guided you early in your life. And then you have this interaction with somebody who perhaps didn't espouse or live this kind of life in a sense, and that influenced you to see that. And then, of course, your work in the banking area, and then finding that there, you know what, there's people who think like you, but who want to do things that are very contributory and value add to the different communities to leave a legacy. So I can see how that shaped you. You know, in your life, you've been involved as a futurist, but you're very much involved in like Web3 and blockchain. Can you talk about that evolution, how you got involved in Web3 and blockchain and global supply chains and so on?
So, in regards to the involvement in Web3, that was maybe a little bit different start than many have. It actually came from when I was in the public sector at the State Department. In my last role at the State Department, I was actually working within the Secretary of State's office working on counter-ISIS issues. Now, one might ask, how does counter-ISIS work, counter-Daesh, counter-terrorism work have to do anything with Web3 technologies and startups? Well, unfortunately, the bad guys were at the edge of technology, so they were using the most high-tech things. But even more so, I was inspired by our partners at different UN agencies. And I know you've done a lot of work with the World Food Programme and other agents from the World Food Programme. Already at that point, were involved with creating blockchain-based digital IDs in Jordan. And in my work, we were working a lot with refugees that are displaced in Jordan. So that's what really started pulling me down that rabbit hole of Web3 and blockchain, and looking at the first point at digital IDs. But shortly after that, when I left the State Department with the idea of pursuing something in the Web3 and the blockchain space, I first looked at my background in diplomacy and development as well, and thought, where can I make the most impact, the most social impact? And in that, I realized agriculture was where the biggest impact you made, given that half of the economy in most developing countries is in the agriculture space. I initially focused on that, and I started looking at how to make supply chain tracking tools. And this is first for coffee farmers, and later we did pilots with turmeric, with cashews, and with other products. And within this system, I also looked at the fact that blockchain at that point, this is now late 2017, early 2018, open creating a wallet using basic blockchain tools was still very complicated. So we made as simple of the tools as possibly could. We had an app that only had four buttons on the screen. So if we had a coffee farmer who's barely went to school, barely literate, he or she doesn't need to know high tech. They just, oh, there's a picture of a camera. I must hit that to send a picture of this. And their digital ID would be linked to the phone they had. So if they sent a photo, their ID, the timestamp, the date stamp, and the location would be added to it. And that was the first product I made in the Web3 space. Since then, I wanted to making other products, regards to tracking the garment supply chain, doing more advisory work in that space. And also realizing, especially back in 2018, 2019, how limited the education was in that space. Now there's so many more training programs and degree programs even related to blockchain. But that time there was less. So with partners in an organization called Gaia Education, we created a program about how to use blockchain to reach the UN Sustainable Development Goals. We taught that at workshops for the BMW Responsible Leaders Foundation. We also used that within the UNITAR system, teaching that for staff and colleagues at the UN Institute for Training and Research. And then from there, that led further both into building new tools, doing more teaching, and also doing more advisory work, especially with UN agencies, with USAID and the European Union, as it related to blockchain use cases.
Yeah, it's interesting, and you talk about your work, you know, with the UN related food programs, and particularly you mentioned the World Food Program. So, did you work with Bernard, who's the head of their Innovation Accelerator, early on, like back in
I
2000?
wish I had.
I see.
Back then, no, I wish I had. He has done amazing work, and I love what his team is doing. And they continuously have more accelerators, additional accelerators. I think they're one of the greatest engines for creating new tools, obviously, especially around the food space, but even to other sectors, the things that come from their work is amazing. But back then, I was traveling to Jordan. I was meeting with the teams that were on the ground in Jordan. So the head of the World Food Program in Jordan at the time, of UNHCR, which is working closely with them, as well as with another YPO member who is the chairman of the company that created the technology needed for that system. They actually had the ID linked to your iris. So an iris scanning device that would be linked to the blockchain, that could be linked to bank accounts, that could be accessed from ATM machines and payment machines and grocery stores. And that was something created by another YPO member who's based in Jordan. And so I went on the ground, met with the people who were there in Jordan, learned about what they're doing. But unfortunately, I didn't meet Bernard until much later. And up till now, so far, it's only been virtually, but I've been really impressed by everything he does.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fascinating. I used to embed that piece with the iris scanners and so on into my keynotes. And I do these keynotes in different places of the world. And it was an example of innovation. So I'm familiar with that program where people have access not only to food, but they also have access to cash as well, right? Using blockchain as means, as an identifier program. So that's fascinating that our roles have touched, even though we didn't meet directly.
Indeed.
You have this background also, though, in diplomacy. Can you tell me how you got into diplomacy and then some of the work that you did in diplomacy? And I know that then the relationships, your experiences would help in everything you do today.
Certainly. And that did start very early. Again, mentioning my uncle and his always talking about history and politics, that was a very early influence on that. And I remember when I was 12, I wrote a letter, a traditional letter to the Department of State asking how one becomes a Foreign Service officer. And they actually sent me back the application pack and the testing schedule and everything. I said, okay, I was 12. I didn't need that yet. But that was long been an interest of being involved in diplomacy in some way, even at a young age, doing Model United Nations in high school, things like that. And Model UN for me was a mix of futurism. I did a future Security Council scenario that I was the chair of course, imagining a scenario 20 years in the future. Now, skipping ahead many years, after I've worked in finance for some years, I've done my master's, worked in development at the African Development Bank, and then joined the US Diplomatic Corps, started out in Cairo, and that was just after the Arab Spring, so a very turbulent time, a very exciting, inspiring time to be there. And I was working with civil society organizations, some that were in democracy and human rights, others that were in economic empowerment, youth empowerment, and entrepreneurship. And gradually, because of barriers the government locally in Egypt placed for us funding human rights groups, we had to either see our bank accounts or funds we distributed being frozen, or see them go to organizations in economic empowerment and youth entrepreneurship, which long term could reach our goals of having a more vibrant civil society, but they were clearly more economic than political oriented. But that's what put me in touch with the startup ecosystem in Egypt as well, working with accelerators, working with places like Flat 6 Labs there, working with Nile University and sponsoring their incubation programs. And Cairo really has a vibrant ecosystem, and we worked to try to expand that to the smaller cities and other parts of Egypt as well. And that was really an exciting time period, and that kept me going with entrepreneurship in the startup space. And another touch back to the tech space after having worked for a dot-com startup during my undergrad years, after having been involved with other organizations involved in that space. Again, my work in Cairo was directly related to that too. After that, I was in Munich and briefly also in Berlin, and both those cases handling relations between Germany and the US and the Middle East, drawing on that background I'd built up in North Africa and the Middle East. And finally, that skill set is what brought me to DC to the Secretary of State's office. And this combination of events had me attending the things at the Munich Security Conference, helping organize secretariats where foreign ministers were coming to Washington, and really did give me a high-level network of contacts globally, both the people I met in the specific cities I was in, but also the people I met who were also global nomads who moved around all over the place. So that was a great starting point that led to my ever-expanding network.
You know, that's kind of fascinating. I mean, you do have this master's from Johns Hopkins and in advanced international studies and international relations and international economics. So I can see how that really inform you in a very broad way as well, right? And you have these concentration, international finance, emerging markets. So again, you can see all of this sort of infusing what you do today. And then you have a bachelor's from New York College as well. So and then you've done additional education programs in the Foreign Services Institute and the Quantic Institute and the Hurdy School. So it's kind of amazing from an educational standpoint, but I would say seeded from your uncle, his work in a way. And then you then working as a diplomat with civil society to funding projects for youth and entrepreneurship. So you could see that kind of YPO element, and we'll mine some of that. Including using technology and reporting, monitoring new technologies that different groups are using, and then that leading to your work at, with Citibank and SMB Global Markets and African Development Bank. It's just kind of fascinating. It's just a number of different areas that you work in. So upgrade that to now. So you mentioned YPO, and can you describe YPO? How did you get involved with YPO? What are you doing with YPO? How do you see YPO being part of your journey, and not only today, but also to the future?
Yeah, so YPO has been something I've been involved with now for almost 6 years, and I see that as really a network to find a pre-clear group of people who are obviously highly intelligent and want to make an impact and want to do something. And I was within that, there's certain networks like the social impact focused groups that are already very clear they're focused on that. But then I see an increasing hunger from others in YPO who come from more traditional backgrounds who want to make an impact, but didn't quite see how to do that running a traditional company. And I see that's a growing area of interest within YPO as people who run more traditional industries or companies are now coming over and saying, hey, that's how I can make an impact, and joining organizations like the People Action Network or the Social, which will soon be called, I think, the Social Impact Network, the Sustainable Business Network, and others. Right now, I'm an officer in the or the incoming officer in the personal, or sorry, throat is cleared or a little clogged up, but in the People Action Network, I'll be the engagement officer there. In the past, I've been the chair of the blockchain subnetwork, which used to be part of the Personal Investment Network, and I'll be have a speaking engagement next week actually for the Sustainable Business Network, presenting on how to use futurist tools to build sustainable businesses and sustainable futures for your businesses. And so YPO is a space where I feel one can magnify their impact to really find the people, the contacts, and the resources to magnify whatever it is they're working on.
I mean, that's kind of fascinating. So I like to mine, some of these futurist tools that you mentioned. So as you indicated, you being connected with the YPO People Action Network, the Latin American Network Board Champion, you're the incoming elected engagement officer, you being part of the YPO Blockchain Crypto Assets and ICO subnetwork. You previously part of the Latin America Network Board Champion. You're definitely involved in related activities like United Nations on blockchain and as an advisor in FinTech for Good, and also on the regulatory side as well in this area. There's just so many different aspects of your contributions, but you've indicated this sustainable business network, and you're doing this kind of futuristic tools. Can you describe what that means, and what does it mean to be a futurist? And then what are the tools that people can use to help future-proof their businesses?
Well, I'm going to first talk about what people sometimes think it is, right? Because sometimes people think it's you've got a crystal ball, maybe not a literal one, but thinking you're going to predict exactly what will happen. And yes, to a certain degree, forecasters try to predict what might happen, but I don't think that's the most effective tool of futurism. The most effective is the tools that we can use to try to open people's minds and see them to help them question themselves. So question what exists today, question what they believe to be true, and really to think out of the box of what could happen. And as they expand their mindset to think of other things that could happen, which they might not have thought of otherwise, then to think about, okay, well, let's ask ourselves, how likely is that thing to happen if I take no action? Is that unlikely? It's a crazy thought anyway, or is it something that actually could happen? And is that something desirable? And for the things that are undesirable but likely to happen, we might think, okay, how can I get into action to stop that? And the inverse for those things that are unlikely to happen, but that would be very desirable, of getting into action for what can we do to change that situation and make those things more likely to happen. And yeah, if you like, we can go through a quick example of one.
Yeah, let's do that. So we get sort of this
Right.
feeling of what this is like, right? So.
All right. So we're going to start with a really simple tool. It's one where we think of all the things that are true about something, and then we think of the complete opposite of that thing that's true. And I'm going to have you start with just a really simple sector, like something that we normally consider maybe simple or boring, just to show how expansive this can be. So let's pick the topic of shoes.
Yeah.
What are some things you can say undeniably, nobody can question, there's no debate, are true about shoes?
I mean, there's so many things, right? I mean, particular sizes, models, colors, what they do from a utility standpoint, from an aesthetic standpoint, who the different manufacturers are. I mean, there's so many things about shoes, even their history and how they came about, right? So.
So let's simplify this to a few sentences. Now we can say, okay, there's many different types and sizes and shapes and colors and designs. There's many different designers. And let's say another example, but let's say you pay money to get shoes. You don't get them for free. So starting with the first one of saying, hey, there's many different designers. Okay, what would it be like if in many different shapes and sizes and colors? What would it be like if in 10, let's imagine 10 years in the future, if there was only one kind of shoe? There's one size. And let's take that further. There's only one manufacturer who makes them all. Now we're sending it to the Soviet Union, right? But what could make that possible? How could that happen?
And then you go through this ideation exercise of how that could happen, right? Totalitarian
So maybe
rule.
we could.
Yeah,
Yeah, totalitarian rule. Russia wins.
of course, you need everybody just a one shoe,
But
that's it. Yeah.
it stretches, it expands, it fits your size. Maybe there's actually some kind of a horrible environmental problem, which we're kind of on the path towards. So we decide, hey, let's make one kind of shoe that's sustainable. You're just going to have that one pair. That's it. And everybody will have the same shoe. Maybe the mental health crisis that people are facing becomes so big that we decide, hey, actually, we're not going to have a variety of clothing at all anymore. Everybody's going to wear something that's simple and ergonomic and functional. And maybe we discover that causes less stress for people because they don't think about what they're wearing. Everybody's wearing the same thing. So that last one, maybe it's actually not so bad or so undesirable as some other scenarios. Another could be if the opposite of you're paying money for shoes. What if shoe companies are paying you and you're receiving money for wearing shoes?
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable.
One of the scenarios this could.
Yeah, you're sort of going through like counterfactuals, right? So.
Yes. So that last one could be like maybe you're getting paid money because the shoes have sensors in them and they're tracking you and the shoe companies are selling your data. Nike makes more money selling your data than they would from you buying shoes from them. And so again, these are all things that like we wouldn't normally think of. If I went straight to saying, hey, I'm going to brainstorm about shoes, I might start with the things that you started saying, but there's many different types, many different sizes. Then I might go to, well, what are new types we could make? What are new colors? What are new shapes they could be in? But not going to the extreme of there's only one kind of shoe, or shoe companies will pay you money to wear their shoes.
Yeah.
And so this is where we kind of stretch outside the box.
Yeah, it forces you to rethink. I can see why you go to opposites then, right? So like these are the known facts, and this let's choose something that on its appearance could appear absurd, and then think in a creative way of how you can make that absurdity actually real, and then it gets you to think of other kinds of modalities of what that shoe could be, right? So that's fast. I can see how that would work. It worked well.
It's a kind of anchoring effect, right? Because we put something so far out there by saying, even if the complete op you've said your true facts, and if the complete opposite it seems totally crazy, we're still going to explore it. And that acts as an anchor, especially if it's really crazy, because then the less crazy things we might get to in this thought process don't seem crazy compared to that anchor, that far out thing that we first thought of. Whereas if we went gradually, minimally thinking of improvements, it might be more realistic and more doable, but our imagination would be expanding less, and we'd be less likely to come up with that innovative new thing that might really change or shake things up.
You know, it's really interesting. It kind of reminds me of Stephen Hicks' Non-Flit, where you talk about the ideal reality, and then you talk about things that are not the ideal reality, and you look at how to creatively you sort of go to sort of a common space based on these sort of opposites that are there, and mine it. That's an interesting tool. I could see that could be very useful. Are there other tools you use? Maybe give one or another example.
Yeah, another very similar one, rather, is imagining just 10 years in the future. And this is a bit simpler in the sense that we're not imagining only like crazy things, but rather we're trying to live in the future and being time travelers. We're obviously physically not traveling time, not yet at least. But what we're doing is really just imagining, hey, if 10 years from now, where am I going to be? What will that look like? And then really pretending you're there. What will it feel like? What am I drinking? What does my drink taste like? What am I wearing in that moment? And then what am I working in? And then gradually taking that from your personal habits and your personal things around you to like, oh, well, the company I'm working in 10 years will be doing this thing instead, or this different thing, or the investments I'm making, or the products I'm using, this is where they might be in 10 years. And in a similar way, trying to imagine the craziest things, the farthest out things there that you could be. Well, for some of those parts, like the products or the tools or things, but you can also be, you could be doing that as well with your regular life of where you live, what you're doing, of saying, yeah, maybe you've lived in California for the last decades now, but maybe you're saying, hey, what would it be like if I moved to Alaska? Would that be a good idea? What would it feel like? What would I be, how would I wake up in the morning? How would that feel? And you could do several of these journeys of really imagining what a life would be that's totally different. And trying to see, like, God, is anything I felt from that desirable? Is anything like that useful? Do I want to pursue any of those things? And so, again, that's more at the personal level, but similar in some ways to imagining the opposites like we were doing.
Yeah, and I can see again where you're thinking across different dimensions, right? And where things could be in 10 years, and then you can go through almost like a reverse engineering exercise of how to get to that point, or what would I have to do personally or professionally, or how would the world have to change? I mean, you can use your question across any area, right? It could be very personal, it could be somewhat abstract, it could be business related, it could be government, it could be the nature of the universe. You could spin this any way you wish, and then you know what is the impact on you, and then reverse engineering as to how you can be involved in some way, or be influenced by that, or how could you influence other communities based on what you're saying, or this idea that 3.5% can create systemic change. So you can have an end state once you want to be and realize that the 3.5% of any community, whether it's a school, a region, a city, a country, or a continent, can move you to that systemic change. Then you can reverse engineer to that end state of just using this fact of 3.5%. And creating many movements that can result in a cumulative movement. I can see this could be endless, and then it's choosing the kind of targets you want to initiate in the discussion. I can see how you can manage this also within a short time frame or longer time frame, depending on how you want to frame those questions, right? So those are really interesting tools and very useful. I could see they're very useful.
What I really love best is when I have the opportunity to talk about these tools with people who maybe feel stuck in what they're doing, but are in some kind of a leadership role. So they're in a spot where they can make an impact, they can make an influence. They're leading a company, they're in a big government agency, but they feel like their creativity is stuck in some way. They're not moving, they're not seeing what other options there are. And whereas these tools can be useful for anybody to open up their mind, to open up their perspectives and think of new concepts, I especially like working with leaders because they're the ones in the position to make a change and to make use very quickly of these new concepts. And hopefully by them opening these doors, they can open these doors and shed light on these new ideas to the people who work with them as well and make a faster impact in that sense. So that's really one of the things that I'm looking to do more of is to try to use these tools, but also many others in a more systematic way with more people who are in leadership roles and keep expanding the use of these tools.
Yeah, or you're a prominent figure in the startup space and innovating among startups and startup communities. I mean, you were a startup boot camp mentor for the Stellar Development Foundation, right? Or you're part of the Knowledge Impact Network, where there's a mentoring projects, and I can see how these tools can work. Or in your past, you're being entrepreneurship mentor, venture capital, and private equity for Africa. And using these tools within that kind of scenario, I can see how it would help you in your past work and how it would help in the sustainable business network of YPO.
Definitely.
Those are really quite brilliant So do you publish a framework of different tools people can use? I know you'll help guide people through this process, but do you also publish through blogs or articles some of these tools that you use?
I do have some things published on my LinkedIn page. That's generally more observations of the recently it's been more of the tools I've been using specifically with economic development projects, with digital economy projects, especially in developing countries, looking at things like payment systems. And it's been more my applications of some of these tools to try to figure out, hey, what's possible and what are things we can create. I'm also working on a book in the background about how to the combination of using some of these tools and frameworks to look at how we deal with this VUCA world that we're living in, how we deal with the volatility, with the uncertainty, the change. And so that's something hoping in the next half year or so to have ready. I have about 60 pages, 70 pages of text ready for that so far. And that's explaining partly how to use these frameworks and partly how to analyze this changing world we live in. So maybe some chapters of that should come out as blog pieces for some teasers.
Yeah, I mean that would be I can see all the different communities where they would m really make good use of these practices, frameworks, and tools, right? Because they're easy to understand, and then because they're so accessible and going through this ideation process and iterating on the ideation process, that be very useful. Kind of reminds me of Christensen's Innovator's DNA. Not that your tools are the Christensen's Innovator's DNA, but I can see how what you do, I can see how their research, it's sort of embedded as part of what they do with this kind of these five sort of pieces of their Innovator's DNA. And it's like questioning, observing, experimenting, associating, and networking. And you go through this process and it creates innovation, but you're doing that through these much simpler tools, right? So, because you can make it so readily accessible, you can personalize it to, you can expand it to any problem. That is really, really interesting. Do you mind if I state in some of this in my keynotes, and I'll source it to Peter
Yes.
Johnson? He uses it. Those are really, really great tools.
A lot of these frameworks kind of build on each other, and like the opposites one that came, Jane McGonigal, the head of one of the directors of the Futurist Institute, she was the first one to develop that. And yeah, some these imagining the future, imagining this time travel idea 10 years into the future is one that she talks about, but also many other futurists talk about. So they're not fully unique ideas, but they're sharing them and getting them out there. And this is one of the things you'll see most futurists are excited about. Is the fact that today people talk more about futurism than they did 10 years ago. And increasingly, more and more people are understanding it and using these tools. So, if anything, I'd love it if you keep using and sharing, expanding these tools with more people, because that means more people will think this way and more people will start questioning things, imagining the futures, and hopefully we'll come up with better solutions for all the world's most pressing problems.
I notice you being an advisor within, I think it's BMW was in your background. I'll just sort of go.
So the BMW Foundation Responsible Leaders Network. So that's a network that started about 14 years ago now. I was re invited to join the network in 2018, and that's a network of social impact leaders globally. As you might guess from BMW being the main funder, it started in Germany and has the biggest part of its membership there. But that's an organization that basically brings people together to really get to know each other, to bond with each other, and then afterwards they start seeing how they can help each other achieve their goals. And it's interesting, there was many people I knew from that network from coming to events that I would leave an event, leave after spending a full weekend with them, feeling like I really knew that person's soul and knew what drove them, knew what they care about, knew what they're passionate about, but not actually knowing what they do for money. So that part of the way the network works is their goal is so much to like build a tight bond between people that they have such a high level of trust, and then you have such a high level of trust with the people you have met that you feel the same towards the other members of the network, even if you've never met them before, that people then really go out of their way to help each other who are part of that network. So when I'm traveling to a new city, similar to how I look around and see if there's YPOs in that place, I also see if there's responsible leaders in that place before I go and try to meet up with them and get a vibe for wherever I am and see where I can contribute, where I can add to what they're doing. And so within that network, I've been active with them since 2018, but since late 2021, I've been one of their network drivers. And that means within the region I live in, I'm one of the people who's responsible for, as a volunteer basis, basically of connecting people and getting to know everyone in the network, helping to coordinate events, helping plan events, in some ways like being a network champion in YPO. And if somebody's traveling, if somebody needs help, if somebody's coming to the region, if somebody's looking for an investor, looking for an advisor, looking for whatever advice it might be or connections to help connect them with the right people within the network or with the networks of people beyond the networks. Because again, everybody who's part of this network is usually part of several other networks as well and can help expand their help from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. In fact, you were named a responsible leader, as you mentioned, by the BMW Foundation Herbert Quandt Responsible Leaders Network in 2018. And you're now invited to be a network driver from a few years ago and ongoing. But that very much ties in, as you mentioned, with YPO and the work they do. It'll tie in with the Knowledge Impact Network, one of the co-founders,
Certainly.
Alain. And the wonderful work, Chitrit, the wonderful work he's doing with his founders. And I should maybe add a bit of context to YPO. I'm not a YPO member, but I've been a resource invited to try to help them. So I've been helping them since, I guess, about 2017 when Florian reached out. But just for the benefit of the audience, that YPO, 35,000 members, there's about 22,000 young next generation that are part of the community. I would say 20,000 plus spouse partners, so roughly about 80,000. I know in 2018, there are a community of 27,000 with 9 trillion in revenue and employing 22 million, but that was before hitting 35,000. So I'm guessing it probably is like 12 trillion. I know you're in 150 countries, you have 500 chapters, you probably employ 25 million. If you were to sort of update. So really, and it's a private community, you have to be fairly noteworthy from a contribution financial standpoint to be able to be a part of this network. So, fascinating that that's a really interesting community that you've been a leader for, as you mentioned, 6 years, driving change and transformation and responsible leadership and so on. So that's a really kind of interesting sort of intersection with these leader networks. But you're also part of the Association for Professional Futurists. Can you talk about that? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a relatively new thing. I was just invited to join that in the last month or so, and that's an organization that recognizes those people who are contributing to the field, who have expertise and knowledge in futurism, who are either leading workshops, who've had publications, who are effectively training people about this space. And so the recognition is simply that, showing that, okay, good, other people in the field recognize that I'm doing something that's useful to that field. That's good. But also the thing that's most exciting about being in there is accessing different other training events, networking with other futurists, learning what they're doing, learning the latest tools in the field, getting more ideas of things I can share with others as I educate others and advise others. The association gives me new tools and new ways, new knowledge to share with others, basically. And people could bounce my ideas off as well as I develop new concepts.
Yeah, I mean, you can crowdsource within a very elite community. So it's interesting that, it's a recognition to be part of that association. You also be invited to join the Global Diplomacy Lab. Can you talk about that work?
Yeah, the Global Diplomacy Lab is an organization that's mainly supported by the German Foreign Ministry and the Slovenian Foreign Ministry, as well as by the Bosch Foundation and the BMW Responsible Leaders Foundation, also is the fourth member of that. And its goal is to try to find a third path to diplomacy, like non-traditional diplomacy. And so, because it does have foreign ministries of at least two countries supporting it, there is traditional diplomats as part of it. And of course, I have been a traditional diplomat. But you have people from social society, social impact groups, from civil society, from the private sector, from various other paths who have an interest in seeing how we can make diplomacy work differently and how we can make perhaps more people-to-people diplomacy, how we can do more conflict resolution. This is where we should somehow get Stephen involved with conflict. And looking at ways to change the world interacts. There's too much violence in the world still. We thought at the end of the Cold War that Francis Fukuyama told us that it was the end of history, but obviously there's still conflict and increasingly more conflict, it seems, at times. And so we're really looking at what are other non-traditional paths and what are ways we can bring together leaders from various countries and various types of organizations and come up with new concepts and new ways. And we're looking to start creating and sharing more of the tools we have as well. We just had a strategy retreat in August for this, and there we were really talking about what are the new paths forward, what can we change? And one of the concepts was, do we niche down? Do we stop being so broad and say, like, hey, we're specialized in conflict resolution. Let's offer this. Let's become like the McKinsey, the Deloitte of conflict resolution, and offer this as a service that the members can have training and provide. And so I think there's still some discussion if we stay broadly looking at all kinds of issues, or if we niche down to one specific thing. Issues that have been talked about in the past by the Global Diplomacy Lab have been media and disinformation. They've been water issues. They've been gender rights issues in specific regions. And when they hold a lab, people come together for 3 days and they really come together, focus on that topic. And by the end of those 3 days, the hope is they have some kind of solution, some kind of idea that can then be published and shared with others to use, especially to be sent to policymakers.
That's really quite fascinating. And I can see the advantages, right, in being able to invoke system-wide change to work in that community. You're also
Yes.
invited to join the International Fund for Agricultural Development Innovation Fund back in 2020. I can see that marrying with the World Food Program Innovation Accelerator headed by Bernard. And in fact, they had a private event a few weeks ago in Munich, sort of co-located in a sense with the Munich Security Conference, and NYPO as part of that. And Cindy McCain was there as well. Is there parallels between this Agriculture Development and Innovation Fund? Do you work with their Innovation Accelerator? Because there's funding within that. And are you advising that Innovation Accelerator as well?
Within EFAD, that's the Innovation Network is more of being invited to be a member and to share ideas. And that's more collectively, all the people who are members of it share ideas back and forth. If somebody has a concept, then they share it with and send it out to all members of the group and then get feedback on it, and also sharing ideas. And so a lot of the knowledge of new tools, especially in the agri-tech space that are coming out, or new methodologies or new ways of, say, working with smallhold farmers, those at the bottom of the food chain or the bottom of the pyramid, like these are things I get from that network, because this is a network of folks who are all very focused on and helping small farmers and helping food improve food production, of helping those who are without but who are trying to produce food for the rest of us live better lives. And it's really a great network of people sharing innovation. I'm certain that many of the people in that are even World Food Program staff, but there's also people who are heading civil society programs, say in West Africa, or who are maybe an agricultural cooperative officer in Southeast Asia. And so there's people at all levels, from senior government policy making roles to academics to people who are working directly with the farmers who are part of that. And so that's a network that keeps growing. And again, EFAD is one of the sister organizations that of the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, with all three having their headquarters in Rome. And I've seen many staff go back and forth between the three because their missions are so closely intertwined with each other.
I mean, I could see you being a good fit for the advisory council for the World Food Program Innovation Accelerator, because you have so many different initiatives of which you are in a leadership role, and all of those insights would be valuable for the Innovation Accelerator. And of course, they're constantly sponsoring new innovation, either through startups or generated internally. And then they have their own boot camp, they have funding for it, they have scale-up programs, they definitely work with different governments, different other foundations. Have you investigated that at all, or been on their advisory
I haven't
council?
looked into it.
Yeah,
Hey, Bernard, are you watching this? Reach out.
you
It
definitely
could be
would.
interesting, though,
I
yes.
mean, I could do an introduction. I'm on the advisory council for a lot, many, many years, so I'll just, but it's Bernhard, right? He runs it, so.
Yes. Yes.
But you'd be great for the advisory council, right? In fact, we had a meeting
That would be very interesting.
a few weeks ago. So And they're always doing these scale up pitch boot camp events as well. You won all of these awards with the State Department, the Meritorious Service Award. You got the Superior Honor Award from the U.S. Department of State. You got such a great history working in diplomacy. And it's a really elite community. So you must work with that community still, even though informally, or sort of reach out or exchange ideas and so on. And I can see you, they would be part of some of the other communities that you work with, but you must still have an active sort of relationship with some of your friends, right? Or ex-colleagues, right?
Yeah, that's been interesting, both not only with friends who are within the state, but also friends who are diplomats from other allied countries.
Right.
Like when I lived in Egypt, for example, my closest friends were diplomats from Slovenia, Portugal, and Britain. And these guys are all over the world now, but I'm still in contact with them quite regularly. And as well, yes, the people within state, as they're moving every 2 to 3 years. And as I simply met so many people in that time working for state, especially being in DC or being at a large embassy like Cairo, that network has spread globally. So that's very useful to reach out. And if I'm in a new place or looking for contacts or looking for information about a specific field, to the degree they can share with people outside the department, they're helpful to reach out to.
Yeah, there's a gentleman by the name of David Bray, and he operates his own private community. I think there's about 300 people in there. There'll definitely be diplomats in there, national and international security experts. I'll try
Oh,
to
David.
join you. Do you know David at all? I'll join you too, and maybe.
Yes. D David was actually one of our expert speakers when the Addy Foundation held a hackathon in 2000, and we were talking about food waste and security issues of food supply chains and how food supply chain national security issues interact with each other. And so he was one of our expert speakers for that. He gave a talk then, and since then we're pretty regularly in contact. He and his network are great. They're fantastic resources. We had them at least at one YPO event too, I believe.
Yeah, so are you part of that community? He's got this about 300. You'd be
I'm
great in
not
that
actually part of that
community.
exact community, no. I should ask him about that.
Yeah, so and you know Davis, so just reach out. He'll add you to the
Yes.
community.
Yeah.
Quite invaluable. I'm part of the community.
Great.
I think they call it a conversation. So kind of brainstorming here with you.
That's helpful. Thanks.
You have these awards, like you got the say, Sir James Wood Award for Community Development. You definitely are community and community development, and it's remarkable you get this recognitions. But I can see all of this even in your early academic career as well. All of these honor societies, it's kind of like an endless series of Eagle Scout early in your career.
Thank you.
You got the top 100 fintech for SDGs influencers recognition. I mean, just the list goes on and on. And when you reflect on all of these honors that you received, does it give the ability then to make it easier to form relationships, I guess, because there's this trust aspect, right? So there's external validation, and you're constantly on the outreach, right? To move things in a positive direction.
Certainly, that's something I can see. If whether it's the awards, whether it's having worked for big institutions that people trust, whether it's having being part of large organizations or networks, whether it's YPO or BMW Foundation Responsible Leaders Network, I see these things as ways that they open doors, certainly. And it helps have the instant trust, whereas otherwise you need to have a conversation and get to know people first. If I see someone recommended to me or contact me who's part of one of these networks I trust, then I'm not asking for references. I'm not digging further around asking who they know or how they got to find out about me. I'm just like, oh, you're a member of that network too? Okay, great. And I've seen people do the opposite as well when I reach out to them, and that's been very helpful.
So so we mined a lot of the work that you've done in your history and the recognitions, the communities you work with. Let's see if we can do a little bit of future look at sort of into the crystal ball, not using tools. And I'd like to get your opinion on different areas, but I'm also sensitive to time. So I should, the audience knows this because I've been doing these interviews for decades, but they're unscripted, and I'm just checking time. Are you have a
I'm
hard
fine
time
in time. I can
popping
keep
up?
going.
Pardon me?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Okay, so there's crypto and then there's blockchain. And blockchain, as you mentioned, the World Food Program has used it for payments and for access to food, and it's a way of providing that sort of democratizing access in a way and make it easier for getting people into secure access for things. You could do data provenance with or provenance of products. You can see the whole history of that product using blockchain. So there's a whole aspect of blockchain, and you being lead with the United Nations Sustainable Development Working Group on Government Blockchain Association. You being Executive Vice President and member of the Board of Directors of Crypto Blockchain Regulatory Task Force. You've done a lot with blockchain in terms of food as well, and including past year, the YPO Blockchain Crypto Assets ICO Subnetwork, which we already mentioned earlier. So there's a crypto side, and you see it going up and down, and you see a lot of regulatory forces looking at crypto and crypto exchanges and so on. I'd like to get your opinion of that. And do you think we're going to get past this point where it's not seen as maybe a bit of a fringe area and become more wider in practice? And then we'll treat blockchain separately because and not associated with crypto and so on. So what are your views of crypto and NFTs and regulations? And do you think it's going to be more accepted broadly across all institutions?
Well, interestingly, I have a publication coming out of that soon for the Center for European Perspective, but I can give away the hints, don't worry. And that paper is only focused on European regulations, not the broader topic. But I do think they'll become more widely accepted. I think that all these Bitcoin ETFs are really laying the groundwork, that big institutional investors are involved, that we see Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan talking about it and buying Bitcoin ETFs and creating their own, whereas a year or 2 years ago, you'd see JP Morgan and all the big banks saying, there's no way we're not getting near this stuff. So I do see it, both crypto and blockchain is becoming more and more regular and more part of our daily life. However, I think what's going to make it really regular and part of our life is when it's the thing behind in the background, when you don't see it anymore. Like, I don't know how to make an app for my phone. I suppose now I could use ChatGPT and that could make one for me. But I don't know how, I don't know enough coding to make an app. I know some coding, but not enough to make my own apps, for example. And that's something where but I know how to use my phone. I don't question what's happening in the background. Now, if we know that data is encrypted in the background more securely because it's on blockchain, if we know our payments are going faster and quicker across borders because maybe our fiat currencies convert into crypto and then convert back into the fiat of the receiver again, if we move entirely to a new system of payments, but still, we do it on our phone, so we don't worry about what kind of payment it is. If it's simple enough that you don't have to worry about it, that it's not the technology's in your face anymore, but it's the thing in the background that secures what you're doing anyway, and you're still living life the way you normally did to a certain degree, but you don't have to know the background technology. That's where it'll be effective. So, for example, now the fact that there's NFTs that can come with your clothing item or come with the physical items you purchase, or that could be tied to land or property. And this gives you that security of the proof of ownership, or that something's not a counterfeit. Even with the garment chain, we created a product on the Casper blockchain that was for this purpose. And with this, that's something where you just say, oh, okay, this shirt, I know where it came from. I know its provenance. I can scan it and I see the whole history of it. I know it's true. I know it's recorded in the blockchain. If I see the shirt shows up as being a different physical location than I bought it in, then maybe it's not true. Maybe this is false because it took somebody else's code. But I see when it's in the background, we don't have to think about it, but it just makes our life easier because it's this thing happening in the background that makes things faster, more secure, more efficient. That's where it'll be mainstream.
Yeah, I mean that's quite fascinating. So what I'm hearing is that you feel that it's going to continue to build gain greater acceptance. It'll be somewhat transparent from people. People won't see it because it'll just be part of the fabric of trust globally. So you have a sort of a positive point of view of where this thing is going. That's what I'm hearing,
Yes.
anyways.
But I think that the language will change in order to bring that positive point of view. People are still scared when they hear the phrase NFT or when they hear crypto. But for example, when Reddit launched its own NFTs, Reddit called them digital collectibles. And people are like, oh, collectibles, those are cute. We like collectibles.
Right.
Reddit sold, I think, $3 million of digital collectibles in the first day. It was a massive NFT sale in a very quick space. But most people who bought them never set up a crypto wallet. When they opened their Reddit account, the Reddit password transformed somehow that it just set up a wallet for them in the background. And so far as they knew, they were buying a digital collectible. They didn't know they're buying an NFT. Just call it a different name. But it was just so easy to purchase, so easy to acquire, and that people just went and bought it. But the terminology, the phrasing is still where people are still scared and a little worried about some of the words about it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the different regulatory regimes around the world are looking deeper, and they want to make sure that they bring some stability to the marketplace, right?
Yes.
That's a really interesting perspective. I noticed in your background, you were a policy advisor, Emerging Technology Committee for People for America in the presidential campaign years ago. But the thing is, you're a futurist and this emerging technology aspect. So I'd like to get your point of view. You've seen ChatGPT come out in a couple of years ago, or more than a year ago, right? And late 2022, definitely escalated in 2023, and now they're working on GPT-5, right? Or you saw Sora come out with this video, which created a big stir. I'd like to get your
Yes, that's
view
amazing.
on AI and machine learning because you're in emerging technologies and it's kind of part of the future. And then I'll get into quantum computing and some of the other aspects that are converging in real time right now. What's your view on AI and machine learning? Do you think we're going to hit AGI? Do you think it's going to be even more pervasive? Do you believe that the hype is real and it's going to sustain itself? Et cetera, et cetera. What are your viewpoints, let's say, 2 or 3 years from now on AI machine learning? And we could make it binary. Do you think it's going to disappear or it's going to be pervasive?
Well, this is an interesting point, right? 5 years, 2, 3 years, 2 years, 5 years, these are distances where we can predict and we can have some reasonable degree of accuracy. When we get to 10 years, if you consider 10 years from, consider Facebook, for example, from when Facebook was founded to when it had 1 billion users, that was less than 10 years. And there's several other examples where you could say in a 10-year span, the whole world, the whole industry can be created in a 10-year span that someone didn't imagine at all at the start of that. But a 5-year span is more predictable. That's probably why I like working with 10-year, because that's where we think of the really crazy ideas that people might think are impossible right now. And we could say, oh, but look, this can happen in 10 years. Anything can happen in 10 years. But 5 years is a bit more predictable and more feasible to say. I think even 2 or 3 years from now, this is something where we'll just be using AI in everything we use. I go to Perplexity before I go to Google, for example. Perplexity, I like simply gives me the sources. So I know there's less false things being said to me then. But I've also used ChatGPT frequently. I've tried out their competitors and constantly checking the updates to see what's working best. But I find it just saves me so much time, whether it's doing research, whether it's getting an outline of something that I'll fill in the draft or I'll do my editing afterwards of it. It just prevents any kind of writer's block. It helps get started with planning. It helps get started with finding the general information, that starting point as well. And then it's the degree that I've got it trained to like know my writing style, which maybe isn't as good. Maybe there's other better writers I should use. But I can say, okay, now clean up this draft I wrote, make it fit more, make this a more attractive draft. You know my writing style, make it fit with the way I write. And that just simply saves me time. And so I could see that as a lot of industries, there's a lot of jobs that just won't be as needed. Obviously, software developers, one can code much faster now. I don't know if I'd go to the extreme of saying don't learn code like some people are saying now, though, because okay, if so many people stop learning code, I guess the tiny point people who amount who can, they'll have an advantage because somebody has to know how to work with the machines and how to develop this. But I do see this becoming more and more pervasive. Whether we get to the point of AGI getting to the level where it's like Terminator Terminator Judgment Day, and we have Skylab taking over the world. I don't know if we'll get to that point, and hopefully we train AI to be good to us. And if AI does take over, it will like humanity, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting perspective. And, at least in the communities I'm working in, people are feeling that, let's look at us living with AI embedded everywhere and how it can augment and help us do things much more easily, which you talked about, right? And any kind of more intelligence that comes with it, or let's not call it that, maybe more capabilities that comes with it, it'll just augment us even further. How about some of the other emerging technologies like quantum computing? There's neural applications being used. Microsoft just recently announced their Microsoft Quantum Elements, where they solve a really big problem. Quantum Elements is where they're combining advanced AI machine learning with supercomputing, or what they call high performance computing, and then with quantum inspired algorithms or quantum computing as it matures, then more of that will come into this sort of combo hybrid affair. And it's available in the cloud, so researchers can use it now. And they did a proof point. They actually discovered a new kind of battery material with a lab, and they prototyped it, and it works. But it couldn't have been done using classical techniques. You had to use this sort of a combination hybrid system of AI machine learning and quantum computing and supercomputing. Where do you think that's going to go? And do you think it's going to create the new novel designs and energy and environment may address the climate challenge? We exceeded 1.5 degrees centigrade for the last 12 months, first time in history, which means that we're probably past the tipping point, and so we're going to need novel ways of doing things. What's your sort of feelings about, well, how much will it disrupt? How will it introduce new kinds of way of thinking? This convergence of, and let's add semiconductors to that too. So advanced semiconductors with quantum computing, exascale supercomputing, zettascale supercomputing, analog computing, and working with AI machine learning. So the underlying hardware working in AI machine learning, what impact do you think that's going to have?
And first off, one of the things I think about is my home region where I came from, upstate New York, Rochester, Syracuse, Buffalo, that area. They're actually seeing massive growth right now because computer chip manufacturers are moving there because the area is relatively cool, has lots of engineers, has massive water supplies. And that also leads to one of the worries. We can calculate new novel solutions to the energy and climate crisis with these computers, but along with AI, along with blockchain, they use such massive amounts of water and energy, especially water, that that's one of the concerns we'll have to work on balancing. Again, I started thinking about each time I'm using ChatGPT, I'm actually also using a massive amount of water. I don't see it, but I am. And so that's the environmental concern is still there on one side. On the other hand, what the things you've described, these systems, they will be finding a cure for cancer, finding a cure for all these diseases, all these things, these problems that we face, that to do laboratory testing would take such immense amount of time, even if it was possible to do. They'll be able to just run scenarios, run tests so quickly, and find mapping the human genome, mapping medical processes in a way that they'll come up with new cures that we can't imagine right now. I also think about material science, as you mentioned, alluded to that briefly. Yeah, can we create more environmentally friendly materials? Maybe we have something that feels like plastic, but it's completely biodegradable and it takes no petroleum to make. Or yeah, maybe again through these same kind of testing and systems, we can come up with better materials, better ways of planning in general then too. I teach as well about ideas inspired by nature and how these can be used to find new systems and new ways of doing things. And there's many researchers who look at the patterns of ants and of honeybees or how dolphin societies work together and look for new models for humanity. And especially the groups that are massive groups in a micro level, like the ants and the bees, if we can make models of those and even faster, quicker systems, we can maybe find new ways to organize traffic and air travel and other things that we as humans face.
Yeah, I mean, there's this incredible ability to recognize patterns in ways that we can't as humans, unless we're assisted, right, by these AI machine learning, supercomputer, quantum computing, analog computing hybrids, and so on. So it's really interesting. It kind of reminds me of ESMFold, this new large language model released about a year and a half ago, and they looked at how amino acids fold into proteins. And 5 years ago, the known protein universe was like 250,000. They applied this technology over days, and they got 600 million. So, and some people estimated it would take it 100,000 years and $100 trillion to do the same thing. And this was considered
Amazing.
impossible, right? If you looked a few years ago, how do amino acids fold into proteins? And we're going to show you 600 million examples. People would have thought they're crazy, right? So,
Yeah, and to be able to analyze the 600 million examples, or actually to view them, or to be aware of them.
how about biomedical innovation? I sit on the leadership board of an institute called the Terasek Institute, and we're doing just amazing, groundbreaking work. And it's funded by a foundation. It's a nonprofit, but we work on translational, so scalable, real practical solutions that could be used worldwide. But I'm reminded of biomedical innovation in aging, for example, Altos Labs, which is still secret, their work, but it's really well funded. David Sinclair, every past couple of years, Time has done a piece on them, including this year in January, where it looks like we can rejuvenate, right? And perhaps that means kind of endless life, but or the ability to have a sort of unlimited lifespan ultimately, but not in 2100, maybe in the next 5 years. And then it's a matter of regulatory, going through all the clinical trials and stuff like that. So, what are your views
Yeah,
on?
regulatory and ethics rules. These will be big challenges, no? The technology might be way faster than our ethics and our rules, and trying to keep pace is definitely a challenge.
Yeah, but on the biomedical innovation side, do you think it's going to result in things that we would have considered a few years ago impossible, and so it almost like the sky's the limit in what the new innovations are coming about? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I'm certain there's not only the innovations that will come, but I also am curious to see how we can manage when we're mapping the brain and mapping how our mind works, in the sense that there's so many things we don't understand yet today. Like if you have an instinct that something bad is about to happen, like you have a gut feeling, as we might call it as well, of something coming. And maybe you even are like, I should leave because something bad's about to happen. And then you find out something bad happened where you just left. And I know of so many cases of people who have something like this, where there's some kind of an instinct or feeling, but we don't understand where that comes from. And I think that's a further step, even aside from finding solutions to the body decaying and things like that, also understanding our mind and understanding to what level we're connected with each other, to what level there's instincts and feelings, and is telepathy something that's possible, and different ways, things that maybe humans 100 years from now, or even 30 years from now, might be like, why didn't people know that? Things that we think of today, right? Like penicillin, obviously a massive changer for simple things like medicine. But the fact that people in some time periods didn't have the awareness of washing their hands, preventing sickness, like things that we take for granted now, people in other time periods had no idea of. So I'm certain there'll be so many things that in the future, and especially in the space of biomedicine, that will just be normal. I wonder, will people still go to school, or will they just get a Neuralink chip with all the knowledge they want to learn and pay a fee for the knowledge they gained? Maybe
This
school will be more about socialization and learning how to deal with people, and not actually knowledge anymore.
yeah, I mean, Elon and with the Neuralink, it's doing clinical trials now on humans, and it's wireless, right? So, or this idea of there's this whole field of quantum biology. Clarice Aiello is one of the top researchers in this area, which suggests that in wet, mushy environments, quantum mechanics is at work. And that kind of work was considered very outlier until a few years ago, but now there's a realization for photosynthesis, for that to occur, there's got to be something else other than classical chemistry. And that's where they think some effects are happening, or bird migration. that signals are so weak, how are they able to follow these weak magnetic lines, then classical explanations don't work. So now they're thinking there's some kind of quantum effect happening. She's taking that work to create new kinds of treatments of disease and or new ways of diagnosing diseases and so on by using non-invasive electromagnetic techniques that are quantum-based. But then further out, and this talks about how do we know through intuition that something is going on? There is a new supercomputer being released this year, which will, it is so powerful, it can do something like, I think, 228 trillion operations per second, some really big, big number. But what they're able to do is model the entire neurons of the brain and the synapses in the brain, 100 trillion synapses in this new supercomputer that's being fired up. And then it kind of reminds me of Roger Penrose, Sir Roger Penrose, who did all of the work with Stephen Hawking, and he got a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago. But he's been positing for, I would say, 3 decades that there's quantum effects happening. And here, and he even has a formula for it. He says it's a property of the universe, and it's the quantum gravity superposition collapse is when you get that iterated in something called orchestrated or then you get consciousness. And so maybe this sort of intuition is part of the superposition that's happening amongst people, or entanglement between you and I, happening at some level that we don't understand yet, but it's happening. Have you looked at any of that work at all, are you curious about that work?
Not specifically that work yet, but I've been thinking a bit about how dark matter might relate to this. And to the degree that there's matter in the universe that we know must be there, because they try to figure out the weight of a star, the speed of it, and it doesn't make sense that we know about physics, but hence the positing of dark matter existing. And I've even heard of some of these studies now looking for the dark matter that they posit must exist near the Earth's core as well, and trying to figure out how that impacts things. So to the degree that between quantum physics and dark matter, I guess, being a subsector of that, like these just new things that are relatively new to even just the scientists and the exploration of it. It's fascinating to see what they're digging into and how many different directions there are to go.
Yeah,
how many things there are that we don't understand yet.
Yeah, I mean, there was just a recent research report coming out where a number of notable scientists was able to show quantum gravity at the smallest level yet. And then now, because they got a method of doing it, they think they can even take it down to the quantum level. And that's the last remaining force that they can't unify between what Einstein believed in and, you know, what Niels Bohr put out and in quantum mechanics. And if they're able to do the gravity side at the quantum level, then they'll have a complete sort of confluence of both the big science physics and the little tiny science physics. So we live in interesting times, and sometimes I posit to people, maybe we're just a projection of a two-dimensional matrix of quasi-particles and superposition, and we're entangled. And time and space and our reality is just a simulation, right? So, so I'm just kind of aggregating some of the thinking that's out there, and that's how you get intuition, or you get people being able to conceive of ideas at the same time and somehow be connected in some level. I have one
interesting to a certain degree. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. So
I was going to say how even science fiction is tying into this now. Some of these, yeah, like in theaters, of course, Dune. Of course, maybe read the book. I've read that years ago as well, and of how these stories and how science fiction sometimes crosses that level of getting to the point like, oh, well, now actually researchers are looking at something that actually is similar to what that science fiction writer wrote 30 years ago.
Yeah, or the author out of China with the three body problem, and you know, Netflix is doing a series of things like that, and all of that. It's interesting, right? What used to be outlier science is no longer outlier, right?
indeed, yes.
So, Peter, I mean, your work is just fascinating, and you definitely are making contributions across so many different dimensions and levels. And As I mentioned, very interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary. It actually fits all of those areas, and each one has a separate definition, by the way. People sometimes think that interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary are the same thing, but they're not. But you do them all and more. So it's just fascinating and just a remarkable history of contribution, accomplishment, and continuing because you're so young yet. And so do you have one final sort of recommendation or thought you want to leave the audience? And that's my last question.
Okay. Well, two, I guess one, I forgot to say where I am now. I'm actually currently in Madagascar for a project with the UN Development Program, and I'm training public sector executive leaders, and I'll be bringing some of this content from futurist thinking to the training with them, and some of it also will be just general leadership training, conflict management, change management, skill sets that executives within the public sector here in Madagascar can definitely make use of. And definitely my first time doing a training fully in French, so that's my new challenge. I keep trying to push for new challenges to find. So okay, let's try teaching in French this time. Where I guess that ties into the overall thought is keep challenging oneself, keep trying to grow, keep trying to learn. And I think that's where we'll keep finding new concepts. And our creativity will increase, our ability to think of new futures will increase. The more we increase the chances we take, the risks we take, the new opportunities we pursue, the new opportunities to learn. So to keep growing, whether it's traveling, whether it's speaking and studying new languages, whether it's trying new foods, whether it's doing a new sport, reading a different kind of book. This is something that anyone from my students in undergraduate that I teach to corporate leaders that I give that advice is, keep growing and learning whatever you do.
Your summary and sort of your recommendations just triggered another question. You have this foundation. Can you give me the root
Yes.
of that foundation? Where did the name come from? And you've got a holding corporation too, and you're innovating
Yes.
the supply chains and Web3 and futurist thinking and methodologies and new business models and et cetera. Can you spend just a few minutes talking about this foundation and the holding company?
Definitely. So the name initially came from my first co-founder for the company, for the private company part, and he's our Suisi. He and I got to know each other when we lived in Munich. Since then, he's moved to Dubai. He's working in the energy sector as an executive there for Siemens. But he thought of the idea because our initial use cases, we were talking about humanitarian assistance. And Ayadi is the Arabic word for hands. So we thought, okay, like hands, helping hands. So we thought that made sense with the initial use case about humanitarian assistance. We didn't work in humanitarian work in the end, but again, instead agricultural supply chains, still development, still social development goals or sustainable development goals we're working on. And so there the name still fit to keep that because we're still looking to help people. So the Arabic word for hands still was a fitting word to keep in that name. Again, the company we've used as a tool to create and develop new tools, new blockchain tools, and also as a vehicle for our consulting practice. On the other hand, the foundation has been an educational system where we've run hackathons, we've also run various fellowships where we'll have guest speakers come in. We have started it during the time period of COVID, so it has been online and so far stayed online because we have such a global audience of both participants and experts and volunteers. This came from with initial support from many YPO members as well as members of the BMW Foundation Responsible Leaders Network, both as experts and as mentors and coaches for teams and participants. And we basically look at what are the emerging technologies out there. Initially, we were only looking at blockchain because that's what we worked with. Now we're looking more broadly. We've added the futurist mindset to the things that we teach and involve in our programs as well. And we're looking to shape future leaders, and especially people who aren't coming from the tech space, and make them aware of what's possible, what they can do, with the idea that, okay, you can find a programmer to build that, or maybe ChatGPT can write the code for you even now. But we try to give people the education, both of that shifted mindset of seeing what's possible and imagining new futures, as well as being aware of what are the emerging technologies that they could use that maybe are still cutting edge, that are still artifacts from the future. They're not the things that are common yet today, but when I say an artifact of the future, that's future speak for something that's a hint of what might be coming down the road, something that 5 or 10 years from now might be more common. So we introduce these artifacts to people and say, here's new things that could be used. We also bring in the traditional business people to say, here's what our industry is currently doing. And we have those young leaders who are there as fellows come up with new concepts and new ideas for how we can bring future change.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite marvelous what you're doing, and you have signature tools like your track tool, right? Or a supply chain tracking using developing countries to say it's a low energy usage, et cetera. And you've done all sorts of pilots. So you've got this garment chain, a Casper blockchain. I mean, and then plus all of this interesting, futurist kind of work that you do, emerging technologies kind of work. And it's just quite marvelous, everything that you're doing and continue to do. And then I'll ask you again,
Thank
any additional comments you make, and that will be definitely my last question.
Well, I think the main additional comment is I'm always happy to meet new potential partners, to hear about new potential projects, to see if there's ways I can support others. If anything I've talked about makes it sound like I've got advice that can be useful to somebody listening to this, then please feel free to reach out, whether it's emailing me directly, whether it's leaving a comment below this podcast. Reach out. I love to be in contact and help out wherever I can contribute. So whether it's coaching people in your business and doing futurist mindsets, whether it's mentoring for a startup, whether it's being an advisory council, whether it's helping find investors for something, or navigate working with the public sector, I'm happy in those or any of the areas that you may have, that we've covered during today to talk on those to help and contribute to others.
Yeah, and then they could also probably reach to you through LinkedIn, perhaps as well.
Right, yes. LinkedIn's an easy way, or through the Addy Foundation website's another way.
Right. So, Peter, thank you for coming in, sharing so many of your insights, and really thoughtful discussion here today. And I very much appreciate all of the contributions you're making for the benefit of all and the benefit of all Earth ecosystems for sure. Just been a real pleasure engaging with you. And by the way, your reputation is just superb. So people
Thank you,
have
Stephen.
been saying, you
Appreciate
gotta talk to Peter for a long time, right? So
it.
I'm
Thank you. Yes, I'm glad we finally have had a chance to talk. It's been a lot of literally years I've been seeing your name and reading your comments and hearing about you since you mentioned you started being active with YPO in 2017. I've been active with YPO since 2018. So, and between the Knowledge Impact Network as well, we've been crossing paths in many spaces.
Yeah, it's good to engage directly. So thank you again, Peter, for doing the interview.
It's my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.